This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, here's the number you'll call, 1-800-462-7413. And intermixed with your calls, some interesting research as per usual.
Yes. Whether or not the Mediterranean diet, the diet that's good for heart disease, is also a diet that might be good for allergies. Some provocative, questionable research that I find fascinating.
We can solve our allergy problems by having the Mediterranean diet?
Maybe we'll kick that around.
Okay.
We'll kick around where that issue is. Yeah. And a new artificial leg that may actually help people walk who have amputations. And this is an issue for returning vets, you know, certainly of the war with Iraq. It's an issue for diabetics, mm-hmm. and it may be a major step forward in sort of artificial intelligence for people who need it for walking.
And what's our recipe? Issue.
Rosemary chops with artichokes. It's a meat recipe, Tom. It's about as opposite tofu as you can get on the spectrum of life.
But I can't think of a better way to goof up a pork chop than by putting an artichoke on it.
Break. Of course we can. We can make pork chops much better. Artichokes are good for our heart and good for our soul.
Okay, and don't forget about our medical myth buster. That's coming up, too. That number again, if you have a question for Zorba, 800-462-7413. Zorba, a listener with us now in the Bronx in New York. Hi.
Hi.
What's up?
Well, I just heard about you guys on the radio, and I think you're great. And I had a question that I've been wondering about for a while, so mm-hmm. I decided to call you.
Okay.
Well, I was allergic to cats growing up. I couldn't even go to a person's house that had cats.
Mm-hmm.
And as I got older, the allergies started to subside. And about a year ago, I got a kitten. And it was working out well, and I wasn't having any allergy attacks. But I've noticed in the last 11 months that I've gotten sick a lot more. I got bronchitis 3 times in one season.
Wow.
And so, and it's taken me longer to get over it.
Mm-hmm. Of
and
course.
I'm wondering if living with an animal that I could be mildly allergic to is making me get sick more.
Oh, you know, these are hard choices in life for you. How long? So you've had this kitty cat for how long?
I've had her for almost a year.
Yeah, and you're attached to her a lot, aren't you?
I love her. She's my little girl I come home to.
She's your bud. You come home and you go, "Hi, honey, how are you doing?" You know,
it's
the cat
great.
Meows, and you know, I mean, I'm a cat person, but we have dogs because
okay.
I'm allergic to cats. But you know, you come home and you just become attached to these animals. You know, that they're. You know, and they have their own personalities. You know, they come up and you know, you think that they know what your
cats?
Emotions are. Tom is not a cat person.
Their personalities are, as soon as you come in the door, they skitter away and then you don't see them.
Cats are wonderful. They're like dogs.
Or else, if you don't like cats, they come up and hang around you all the time.
Oh, God. You know, you can just tell what his view of cats are. Now, I've got a couple questions. When you go away on vacation, okay, do you notice any difference at all when you're leaving the house? I mean, do you ever get away from the house for 3 to 4 days or something and have somebody else come in and take care of the cat? Has that happened? Any difference at all?
No, not at all. I was gone for about 9 days and came back and cuddled with her and no allergic reactions.
Okay, what do you do for a living?
I work for an underwater construction company.
Underwater
construction company? What is an underwater construction company?
We fix bridges and dams and quarries, and we build the deep saturation systems that they dive with down the Gulf to fix the oil lines.
Well, do you work underwater?
No, I stay on land. I'm in the office.
You're in the office, which is above water. You're in the office. Well, I don't think you're necessarily allergic to this cat. I'm gonna make a statement like that. Usually, if you're allergic to the cat, you're wheezing, you're itching, you're smell, you know, you're sniffling. When you get away from the house, you go, "Gosh, things are better." You come back to the house, things are worse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things that happens with colds and infections like this is sometimes you can go for years and you don't get them, and then you can go 1 year and you can have 2 or 3,
mm-hmm.
and it's quite interesting. Years ago, my wife used to get lots of colds, lots of chest infections. She no longer gets them, and I never got them years ago, and now I get 2 or 3 chest infections a year often. Now, this year I got one, but the year before I got 3, and they were just kind of awful, and I thought, what am I doing wrong? And it's nothing that I'm doing. We have an animal in the house, a poodle, but we've had poodles now for about 20 years. Standard poodles, great dogs, better than cats. Ah! Anyway, I won't say that. But so I think you're okay. I don't think it's a cat thing, but I would keep the dander down. You know, I would make sure that there's not a lot of cat fur around. That would be one thing. Another thing you can do is get an ionizer for your house. These are little funny contraptions that throw ions into the air, and what they do is they actually cause the dust and dander to stick to the wall. It's a funny thing, but it charges the dust in the air, and when the dust is charged, it sticks to the wall like glue. And so it really does cut down on the dust in the house, and I'm a great believer in them. They're not – you can buy cheap ones and expensive ones. Go for the cheap because they seem to be just as good. But I don't think you're allergic to the cat. So I don't think I – and you're not going to get rid of the – you know, to get rid of a cat's a big issue.
Sure.
You know. So I think you may have just been coming into contact with people who have bronchitis. One of the things you can do is also use Purell and these other sort of hand sanitizers. I really think they cut down on viral infections. And they help a lot. So.
Okay.
So, good
Great.
Luck. Well, thanks for listening. You know, spread
Thank
the word.
You.
We love calls from New York.
Appreciate that call. You didn't recommend the Mediterranean diet.
No, I didn't recommend
you,
Mediterranean diet.
Let's get to that research that maybe the Mediterranean diet can
kind
prevent
of, it's kind
allergies.
Of, kind of questionable research, but it's rather interesting. Now, this took place in the Greek island of Crete. British scientists went to the Greek island of Crete in the winter and looked at 700 children and spent months on the Grecian island of Crete.
Tough duty.
January, February, and March studying children. You got the picture? Yeah. And then they had to go back the next year and also do the same
thing. Oh, no.
They had to leave Great Britain in the middle. And they looked at respiratory symptoms and dietary. This was a tough study.
They probably have to go back year after year to make sure their findings
are. They ought to go to Greenland, you know, and northern Canada to do the same thing with the Eskimos to see, but I don't think they're doing that. And they basically looked at kids, and they looked at kids who tend to not eat Mediterranean diets, even in the Mediterranean Sea.
Yeah.
And they looked at kids basically who ate fruits and vegetables. About 80% of the kids had fruits twice a day, had vegetables three times a day, two-thirds had vegetables three times a day. So, yeah, that's a lot. And they looked at the ones who didn't have fruits and vegetables, who basically ate more carbohydrates and a diet that was not rich in that. And they found, basically, that the kids who ate a healthier diet were less likely to have asthma symptoms and skin allergies. Okay, so you look at this thing and say, well, that's kind of interesting. Is this real or not real? Well, if you look at asthma in our society, it's a big, big issue. Mm-hmm. The death rate of asthma is increasing. The death rate, the asthma rate within the society is increasing. Our asthma treatment has gotten better and better. We're using more and more inhaled steroids and other drugs for asthma. Even though we're doing that, death rate is increasing. Mm-hmm. Asthma is increasing. Mm-hmm. We don't know why. We think that it may be due to small particulate matter of air pollution in our society. We know, for instance, that asthma is much worse in the inner city where there's more pollution, so we think it's that. Maybe we're on the wrong track. Maybe it's not just air pollution.
Maybe
it's fruit and vegetables.
Yeah.
Maybe it's that when we have a diet that is more fast food, carbohydrate loaded, high fructose diet, maybe it's also a dietary issue and nobody's looking at that. And the fact is, this is rather provocative. Maybe diet plays a role also in asthma. Now, we know in richer parts of our society, you eat more fresh fruits and vegetables because they're more expensive. And we know in poorer parts of our society, we eat less fresh fruits and vegetables. Maybe asthma is partially a dietary issue.
Mm-hmm.
So, as crazy as it is, as strange as this is, I mean, I want to go to Greece to do this next winter, too. Maybe the antioxidant effects of fruits and veggies are actually good for asthma. So I find it kind of fascinating. I mean, we need more research.
And if this is not true, it's still a pretty good diet.
No, it's a good diet. We know it's a good diet for heart disease. It's a good diet for stroke. We know it's better for adults. And, in fact, it's better for children because you start to – I mean, I was amazed that two-thirds of the kids ate two servings of veggies every day and 80% ate fruits every day. You know, in our society, it's hard to get kids to do that. Well, it's clearly not a taste issue. It's a society issue.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number. A listener with us now, Zorba, in Prattville, Alabama. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
I have tinnitus, and I would like to not have tinnitus.
How long have you had it?
Long time.
And how bad is it?
Bad. It's constant. I was told to get one of those ocean machines, you know, to drown it out.
Mm-hmm.
But I couldn't find a 30-mile-long extension cord.
In other words, you wanted to get it from the ocean.
Yeah.
That's very good. I like that.
Yeah.
Well, tinnitus is an issue. What kind of work? What'd you do for a living? What did you do for a living when, you know?
I'm in sales.
So you're not around machinery. Were you in the service? Were you around loud noises when you were younger?
10 years in the Marine Corps.
Well, 10 years in the Marine Corps, we'll do it. By the way, as an aside, did you apply for disability because of this?
No, I have not.
You should do it. You should.
That's
definitely.
What my wife keeps telling me.
Well, your wife is right. You know, she gets points for that. You gotta pay attention to she who must be obeyed, as I say in my house. She who must be obeyed is often right. The day, by the way, you apply for the disability, even though you don't get it, that's
right.
The day from which it starts. So if you apply for disability today, tomorrow, or the next day, and you get it a year or 2 years later, it goes back to the day the application is filed. And if you were in the Marine Corps for 10 years and they didn't offer you protection, then your tinnitus. Or tinnitus, doesn't matter which way you pronounce it,
tinnitus.
Is probably caused by that. So I want to mention that because, you
okay.
know, if you're not around machinery otherwise, and you deserve to get reimbursement for that. I mean, that's part of what we give our vets, that, you know, you were in a hard position. You were in the Marine Corps, and I feel very strongly about that. So
your wife
is right. That's step number one. Now, what do we do about the tinnitus? Well, we don't solve it, first of all. It's due to injuries from loud noises. Now, some people get it from ear infections. I have a little bit of it. I've never really been around loud noise, but I wear earphones all the time. You can get it from that. And basically, it's a problem with the cochlea, it's called, and this is the inside of the ear, and it's a problem with it. So when your brain attends to other things, you can ignore it. When your brain is trying to shut off, you can't ignore it. And so what we do, the best treatment for it, is to basically have something else that is going through the ear sensory system to help us ignore things. That's what it is. And it's not just that the ocean sounds help people ignore it. It's something that's going on. It's a very interesting thing. Let me tell you what I do personally. What I do is outside my window, I have lots of wind chimes. I happen to love wind chimes. I have 10 wind chimes outside my window.
Oh.
And I open up the window in the wintertime, too. I have the window slightly open. And the wind chimes are ringing all the time, which I happen to love. But I realize the reason that I love it, because sometimes in the middle of the winter, it gets much colder in Wisconsin and Alabama. Let me tell you, we have cold winters.
Oh, yeah.
And if I open up when it's 20 below zero, if I open up the window, she who must be obeyed is very unhappy with me. And I've discovered that when the windows are closed, I hear my tinnitus.
Yeah.
So the way to treat it is having something on in terms of sound. It doesn't have to be the ocean, but it has to be something. So one way to do this is to have a music that you find non-intrusive, that is background music that is okay for you. Now, for some people, that is talk radio. It's a public radio station, or it's talk radio, or it's, I mean, see, commercials are not good because they are louder on the radio station. They pump up the volume for it, and you tend to attend to them. So you want to find what you like that is a background to you.
All right, sir.
And good luck.
And apply for compensation.
Absolutely apply for compensation. It is your due. You served us. You deserve that compensation. Apply. Your wife was right.
Yeah. This is actually in the inner ear because I talked with a friend just the other day who suggested that he said he heard from, I think, a medical person that it was actually in the brain.
Well, let me explain that.
Yeah.
It's actually a problem of damage to the apparatus, the cochlear apparatus in the ear.
All right.
The issue with the brain is when you ignore the sound, it's not intrusive. So you see, when I'm talking now, we don't notice the tinnitus.
Yeah.
The fact is there's the same damage that occurs in the cochlea, but we're talking, so we don't notice it.
Yeah.
It's when it's quiet and when you're at rest, you tend to notice it. So part of it is attention from the brain. If you think about it while you're talking, if you have tinnitus, you can find it there. It's in the background.
As you know, I had it and it went away, so this means that I have a very strong brain that I was able to force it out.
That's it, baby. Your brain is a strong brain.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And Zorba, listener now in Eagle, Idaho. Hi.
How's it going?
Good. How can we help you?
I am going to be donating a kidney next week to my mother, and I was wondering what I can expect as far as recovery for myself and her.
Wow. Well, how wonderful is that? Thank you so much
for
doing that.
It's his mother. It's not as though
It doesn't matter. It's surgery. It's, it's a big issue.
Anybody donate a kidney for their
mother? I think it's still something. You know, you're going through it. I think it's a
well, you're a good guy, I'm sure, but I mean, I wouldn't go
as
far as
over. You're donating to your mom. How old is your mom?
My mom's 57.
57, young person. How'd she get it? What kind of kidney disease does she have?
It was from diabetes.
From diabetes. Mm-hmm. So, first of all, if everything goes well, you know, the main thing you're going to have is pain. That's the issue.
Yeah.
So the issue is pain because you have surgery, she has surgery, she's recovering from the surgery, she'll have a tougher time because she's a diabetic, you know, so she still has that problem. But still, the issue from surgery is pain. From her point of view, it's pain keeping her blood sugar under control. Does she have any other medical problems, heart disease at all, problems with stroke, cholesterol, high blood pressure?
Her blood pressure is a little high, but the only thing she also has, she has chronic illness anemia from the diabetes.
From the diabetes. So those are really her issues. So she's going to have a, you know, her recovery is going to be slower, a little bit tougher. It's going to take a little bit more work. It's going to be more medically intensive than yours. From your point of view, the real issue is the pain, you know, that happens afterwards. And so when is the surgery? How long from now is the surgery? How many weeks from now is it?
It's actually in 8 days.
8 days, okay. Oh. Do you exercise? Are you an exerciser?
I do.
Okay. So what you really want to do in preparation is you want to pretend that you're preparing kind of for a marathon, you know, or an exercise thing. You want to get your body in, you know, primo shape. You want to eat really right for the next 8 days beforehand. You want to be very good in terms of your food. You want to be as relaxed as you can because, once again, your body's going to recover really well from this. But it is an internal surgery, and so you want to make yourself as well as you are. And realize that you are going to have some pain afterwards and ask for painkillers. You know, your doctor is going to give you painkillers, but don't be afraid to take them. A lot of people after surgery go, well, I'm not going to take painkillers. You know, I can tough it out. I don't believe in that at all. I believe you take the painkillers that you need because you're going to recover from it afterwards. So I would just, from a physical point of view, it's really just eating right and keeping up that exercise. But from a mental point of view, it's spending time with your mom because you're going to look at your mom very differently afterwards. And she's going to look at you very differently. She's going to look at you as having part of her, and you're going to look at her and say, part of me is in you. And there's a very, very different feel. People who give of kidneys to other people, they have a very different feeling about that person because you're connected in a completely different way. So I want to just congratulate you on that. It's a big thing. Pain is your bottom line issue. You're going to do just fine.
Thanks for calling us at 800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, a listener with us in Knoxville, Tennessee. Hi.
Hey, how are you?
Fine. How can we help you?
Well, there's something that I have been doing for quite some years, off and on, which is, since I live in Tennessee, I call it Appalachian resistance training, which is drinking beer while I lift weights.
Drinking beer while you lift weights?
Appalachian resistance training.
Drinking beer while you lift weights. Now, that's very interesting.
I'm talking, you know, like having two or three light beers while you might work out for an hour, and I listen to National Public Radio and kind of relax in my basement and do that. Uh-huh. So. Hey, I'm very trim. I'm 44. I weigh, you know, like 165 pounds. And I just wondered if it was, I shouldn't be doing that.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, having a couple of beers a day is okay. Two drinks a day for a man, one drink a day, or a drink and a half a day for women, depending on their size, really has been shown to be heart healthy. We know, and every time I talk about this, I always get email, but we know that teetotalers, now this excludes alcoholics who can't drink alcohol. That's a totally different thing. Take away the alcoholics. People who by choice do not drink have a higher incidence of heart disease and stroke. Study after study after study has shown this. And we don't know why. We know that it's not the grapes in red wine. We know that it's the alcohol. And we don't know if it's the relaxation from the alcohol or a direct effect from the alcohol. So the fact is, whether or not you drink your beer at night in front of the tube, you know, or your glass of wine at night in front of the tube, or when you're having dinner, or whether or not you drink it when you're doing your resistance training, probably doesn't make any difference.
What?
I certainly have never seen
he's
that.
He's listening to public radio while he's doing that training.
That's true, actually.
It makes a huge difference.
You know what?
Difference.
That makes the difference. That is your shield against the side effects of alcohol. You're right, Tom. Absolutely right. Public radio is your shield. As long as you keep the public radio on, man, you're okay. It is okay to do it. You can then drink beer while you're doing it. Now, I've got a question. Is this the Appalachian way of doing weight training? Is this individual, or is this kind of common practice?
I don't know how many others got.
Well, maybe they do. You know, we've never done a survey to find out how common it is to sit down. I mean, why does it have to be fruit juice when you're, you know, with high fructose corn syrup that'll add on weight? Why can't it be beer? I mean, you're right.
That's exactly the way I think of it. I think of it as, you know, it's made from grain. I just think it's like liquid cereal.
I agree. Yeah, it's kind of cereal. Yeah, we could. I think we can do something better for the Miller and the Bud commercials, and we can say use it. You know, instead of Gatorade, light beer while you're exercising. We've got a whole new way of looking at beer. I like it.
Yeah.
But seriously, you know, you can drink two drinks. There's no evidence of when you drink it makes a difference. Some people say it ought to be with food because that's the way they do as a Mediterranean diet. But I think you're just fine. Two drinks a day are just okay. And keep up the good work with exercise and support public radio.
Thanks a lot for calling. More coming up here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. We have more of your calls, of course, some more interesting research, our medical myth buster, and our recipe. Our recipe for some kind of a pork chop.
It's wonderful. It's rosemary chops with artichokes.
Artichoke.
Mm, yeah. Good.
Coming up on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Recipe time and then to your calls at 800-462-7413. But Zorba, we have a pork chop recipe which is sitting right in front of us as we speak. Pork chops, rosemary chops with artichokes.
That's right. Doesn't that sound good? I mean,
everything about it sounds good, except the artichokes.
I happen to love artichokes. I love artichokes anyway. I mean, years ago, I went to the artichoke capital of the world, Castro, California. I've got a picture of my son, Zachy. This is 28 years ago, and his little baby.
Sounds fascinating.
Right. Give me a break. But artichokes are great. You know, didn't you sit around? I remember sitting around in the 60s, boiling the water, doing the artichokes, thinking about
life.
Sorry,
folks. We're out of time. See you again next week here
on
Zorba Pastor.
You know, pontificating about things are good.
All right. Let's do the recipe.
Okay. Start out with 2 tablespoonfuls of olive oil.
2 big tea olive oil.
That's right. 2 tablespoons of olive oil. We're going to talk about how we use it. 2 large shallots sliced.
2 large sliced shallots.
That's right. 3 cloves of garlic.
3 cloves of garlic.
Right. If you like more garlic, put in more garlic. Okay. 1/2 teaspoon of chicken bouillon.
A chicken bouillon.
That's right. So we're going to use that. That's going to be basically our chicken-flavored salt. Now, for those of you who are vegetarians, this is not a recipe because we are using pork loin.
Well, why do you want to put chicken-flavored salt on a pork? Recipe.
Well, because it tastes really good. That's why. I mean, okay. I happen to use chicken soup in a lot of different things.
Okay.
I mean, it's one of the soupy things that I like. 1/4 teaspoon of crushed red pepper.
1/4 crushed red pepper.
That's it. 1 8-ounce package of frozen artichoke hearts thawed.
Okay, one of those. 8-ounce package frozen artichoke hearts thawed.
That's right. Now we've got our pork loin chops. So they're 1/2-inch pork loin chops, 4 of them.
Yep, 4 1/2-inch. Pork loin.
Right. So, I mean, pork loin is going to be the thing about pork loin. Anything with loin in it means it's going to be lower fat. It means it's going to be a higher in protein, lower in fat, which means lower in calories. Mm-hmm. That's what we're using. 2 tablespoonfuls of white balsamic vinegar.
2 big tea white balsamic vinegar.
Right. You could use really any vinegar, but white balsamic's going to be a little bit better. If you use the dark balsamic, it'll still have that good balsamic taste, but it'll have a different color. 1 tablespoonful of chopped fresh rosemary.
1 big tea chopped fresh fresh rosemary.
Now, if you don't have fresh rosemary, I assume, especially in the summer months, you could use fresh basil or something else. But there's something about rosemary that I mean, I happen to really like. Mm-hmm. But the fresh stuff is what you want to use here. S&P to taste.
Right.
S&P to taste, and the salt you should use is either sea salt or kosher salt, and the pepper used should be fresh ground pepper because it really tastes better. I mean, if you use a freshly ground spice, it really tastes better. Okay, yep. Here's how we make it.
While I eat.
While you actually eat this, that's right. So heat half of the oil in a large skillet, that's a tablespoonful of olive oil. Mm-hmm. Add the shallot, garlic, bouillon, and crushed red pepper. Cook, stirring occasionally until the shallots are tender. How is it? Good?
Yeah. The artichoke hardly ruined the chop.
Hardly ruined it. It's really good. Well, I'm going to eat the artichoke when you do that.
Yeah.
Stir in the artichoke hearts make it better, Tom. It's healthier. Cook it, stir it occasionally until the artichokes are cooked through, and then transfer that to a medium bowl. Now, take the remaining oil in the same skillet. That's another tablespoon of olive oil. Add the pork. Cook it on one side. You're going to saute it on one side until brown. Now, remember, you're only using one tablespoonful. That's only 100 calories of oil that you're using. You're using extra virgin olive oil, so you're going to give it a really, really good taste on the surface of your pork loin. So this is a good way of using a good fat. That's what we want, good ways of using good fat. Mm-hmm. Turn the pork over, reduce the heat to medium, then add the artichoke mixture, then sprinkle with the vinegar and rosemary. So at the end, you're taking this vinegar and the rosemary smell, and you're covering and cooking it now for 18 to 20 minutes until the pork is no longer pink in the center, or use an instant meat thermometer, and it goes, I believe, to 165. I might be wrong. It might be 155, but 165 will definitely do it. And you can keep pork pink if you want to, because there's no trichinosis in pork in America today, and it hasn't been there for 20 years. Then, sprinkle with salt and pepper, and bon appetit.
Yeah.
And give this to me.
I will in a second. I'm going
like
to say first that Chef Adam Friedrich
That's
did a
right.
wonderful job.
Our chef did it. Chef Adam
newly,
Gibbons.
By the way, newly engaged
oh,
as
Oh, my
of last
goodness.
Week.
I didn't know
yes,
that.
Yep.
Congratulations,
so,
Chef Adam.
So
newly engaged.
Gal, sorry. All the women are so, oh, no.
Oh, my God. Chef
He's
Adam
off
is
the
engaged.
Market.
That's
He's
why he was so excited to go down and visit his girlfriend. Chef Adam.
Absolutely.
Chef Adam made this. I'm going to have a little taste
for
this.
That's pretty good stuff.
Oh, God.
Tastes good. Let us send you a copy of this recipe. Address your request to, leave off the ums for a while.
Gotcha.
Address your request to Zorba Pasture on Your Health, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin, our zip code 53706. Be sure, though, to enclose a self-addressed, stamped, business-sized envelope so we can send the recipe along to you.
Or come to our website at zorbapasture.org. You'll find that recipe. You'll find other fine recipes, too. And you can sign up for our podcast.
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. Question for Zorba, that's the number to call, 800-462-7413. Zorba, a listener with us now in Valley, Alabama. Hi.
Hi, guys. And what? By the way, I'm crushed about Chef Adam being engaged.
all the women are.
They're all crushed. They're all crushed.
Sorry.
Right. They're hanging crepe in Valley, Alabama.
I knew that Adam rocks, but I didn't realize he rocks down there in Alabama.
Well, try to get over it and tell us how we can help you.
Okay. And by the way, Adam's turning red. Just thought I'd let you know.
How can we help?
Okay. Back in December, after a blood test showed I had really, like, awful cholesterol levels, my doctor and I talked it over, and I vowed to really make some changes. As of my new test just the other day, I've managed to get my cholesterol totals down to 144, and my bad cholesterols, my LDLs, way down into, like, 80-something. But the problem is my good cholesterols, my HDLs, are still pitiful. And though my doctor is a lovely man and, you know, a wonderful internal medicine doc, he didn't have too many suggestions for how I could raise my HDL, so that's why I come to you.
How pitiful is that HDL?
It's like 40-something.
Well,
that is not pitiful. That is not pitiful at all. For anything above 35 is really okay. You don't
really?
Lose points. Oh, yeah. Once
oh.
we the real the I'll tell you what it is. It's men and women with an HDL in the 20s. That's really the issue. That is a genetically low HDL, and that becomes an issue. If you had an HDL of 20 or 25, that's the issue. But frankly, you know, there are a lot of labs that say above 35 is fine. Anything above 50 or 55, and you begin to get points on that. But really, well, above 35 is fine.
Your bad cholesterol is really good. What were the numbers on that?
My bad cholesterol went from 159 down to 80-something.
Oh,
yeah,
fabulous.
80-something is great.
That is I have to tell you.
And I've done it with diet, too, because I tried a statin drug and I had awful side effects, like horrible mm-hmm. muscle
oh, that,
cramps.
My wife, same thing. She had, her cholesterol was up there, and she did it with diet, and she's gotten on not quite to your level yet, but you can do it just with diet.
Well, the doctor did say he wanted me to raise my HDL some more, so do you have any suggestions for me?
Well, first of all, let's. I want to talk about this diet thing because it's an issue. Not everyone can do it by diet. Some people can do it by diet. In other words, some people genetically produce too much cholesterol and they can go on the cardboard diet and it doesn't make a difference. But other people, if they go to a more Mediterranean diet, alter their cholesterol, you know, alter their dietary intake of cholesterol and do other things, they can have a dramatic response. So I want to congratulate you for that dramatic response. And that's really the first step. The first step is, okay, I've got high cholesterol. I'm going to be really, really good. I'm going to be perfect for 3 months and then measure my cholesterol. Let's see what it does. And if it doesn't do anything, then for people at risk, you got to look at drugs. But for the person who does it, then they have a choice.
Yeah.
How much do I have to restrict my diet? How much do I want to do it? Now, HDL. What elevates HDL? It's basically exercise and probably a bit of alcohol, red wine and alcohol. And those are the things. Now, other than drugs, there are drugs that elevate it. But an HDL of 40, I certainly wouldn't put you on
over
drugs.
40.
Well, I like the red wine part.
A glass of red wine every day may elevate your cholesterol. But I'll tell you something. You go to the National Cholesterol Education Program website. If you write down heart risk calculator, you Google that word, okay? Heart risk calculator, those words. You will come up with a calculator. You put your blood pressure, you put your age, you put your HDL cholesterol, your total cholesterol, whether you're a smoker, whether or not you have high blood pressure, and so on there. And it'll show you your 10-year risk of having any heart disease. That's the issue. Really, we shouldn't care about cholesterol. We should care about the constellation that causes heart disease. Okay, you look at that risk, and you change your HDL in there. And I don't have, you know, it's a little calculator from Framingham. I don't have it in front of me. My guess is it doesn't change more than 1% because your numbers are awesome. Your numbers are awesome.
Okay,
so.
Well, all thanks to oatmeal and blueberries and olive oil and sardines.
Wow. See? And sardines.
Yeah, I love them. But
so you love sardines. What kind of sardines do you get? You get them with mustard or with oil sardines?
Oh, I have a whole, like, smorgasbord of sardines in my pantry, some of them with olive oil, some with soybeans, some with the mustard sauce.
I love that stuff. If you ever go to an Asian grocery store, you can get a lot of other kinds of sardines with Thai spices and other things. Yeah, which is good.
Well, not in Valley, Alabama.
Yeah, Tom is not a... Yeah, Ryan, that's right. It's not where you can get it over there.
That's fine. You can go. Anything else you'd like to talk about?
But sardines are great. They are a cheap way of getting omega-3 fatty acids, and for people who like them, they're fabulous.
And by the way, if you knew the dark side of Adam, you wouldn't be so upset about him getting a drink to somebody else. Trust us. Those of us who really know him.
Okay, I'm hanging up now. I'm hanging up. I don't want to hear this.
Okay, bye-bye. Thanks a lot for the call. 800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. A listener now in Buffalo, New York. Hi.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
Fine. How can we help?
Well, I'm kind of in a unique situation. I'm 27 years old, and about 2 months ago, I was diagnosed with cataracts, and also they found the presence of drusen formations in my retina. And I was just wondering, should I be worried about problems like macular degeneration?
Well, first of all, you're right. At your age, cataracts, let's talk about that, are really unusual. How'd they find it? I mean, you know, did you go to the eye doctor and they just picked it up, or were you having symptoms?
Well, I actually went to an optometrist because one thing my girlfriend noticed was that I couldn't see street signs at the same distance that she saw them.
Oh, okay.
They would be kind of fuzzy for me.
Sure.
So I thought, well, maybe I need glasses. So I went, and the optometrist said, no, you have 20/20 vision. So that's when he took a physical exam, and he said, wow, he said, I don't know what to tell you. I've never seen this before, but I think you have cataracts. So he sent me to an ophthalmologist, and ophthalmologist confirmed the same thing. But he didn't really go too far in the way of suggesting what to do, other than he suggested that I have surgery, but I actually am going to, I've decided I'm not going to have the surgery yet, because my vision still isn't that bad.
Well, I've got a couple suggestions. First of all, and you've got drusen, which is an abnormality of the retina that can occur in a variety of situations. You need a complete physical examination. You need to have blood chemistries to make sure you don't have diabetes. You've got to go to a good family doc or an internal medicine doc to make sure you don't have another medical problem. That's the first issue. Now, from a cataract point of view, I would get a second opinion. The answer in one way is yes. I'm not going to have my cataracts done now because I can see, I can still make it out with it. On the other hand, cataracts don't go away. So if you've got a cataract and we have very good cataract surgery, you know, we put a lens in the eye and it works well, it is eye surgery. But on the other hand, a lot of guys your age and women your age end up having, you know, LASIK surgery on their eye so that they can see without glasses. The fact is they see much better. If you have a cataract and it's really there, you then have to say, well, why do I want to live with it? And my own thought is, after I would think about it and I would get a second opinion, I would have the surgery myself, because if it's not going to get better, I would say, if I'm going to have it sooner or later, why don't I have it done? Now, it is surgery. On the other hand, you're a 27-year-old, you're healthy. Cataract surgery is done really, really well these days, and the complication rate is really, really low.
Yeah. Is there any harm in waiting for the surgery?
No, there's not any harm in waiting for the surgery. Yeah. But you've got to have a full medical workup to see if there's something that is actually causing this. And once again, this is a very good example of where I would say, I can't put together cataract, this drusen abnormality in the eye, and a 27-year-old who's healthy. But there are medical problems that can occur, and the physicians who are in our listening audience will undoubtedly send me emails that will do that. But the first step I look at is I would Google this, and then I would also then send them, you know, if I couldn't come up with an answer with that and the other search engines with something else.
Thank you very much for the call. Before the break, Zorba, let's take a quick question from Elaine in Knoxville, Tennessee. You're going to cringe at this one, by the way. She would like to know if it's unhealthy for coffee made one morning to be reheated for the next. She's been doing it for years.
Oh, it's not unhealthy at all. It's just disgusting.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's just disgusting.
It doesn't taste very good. It's disgusting. The aliphatic hydrocarbons that make coffee taste so good aren't there. I mean, you might as well have Nescafe instant coffee. It would be just as good. Ugh, yuck.
You know how,
it's not bad for you.
You know how my Uncle Dudley used to brew coffee? You don't, I'll tell you.
No, but I've heard about Dudley.
My Uncle Dudley used to brew coffee by taking the pot, coffee pot, without the thing where you remember the thing you used to put the coffee in the basket? He didn't have any basket. Yeah. He put the coffee in the pot, he'd heat it up with water, and then he'd pour it in the cup.
Oh, with the grounds and everything?
Yes.
Oh, God, Dudley.
And he let him settle a little bit.
Dudley.
I think he didn't want to wash the
good
thing.
Good old Dudley.
Didn't want to wash the thing.
Yeah, that's what Dudley was like, wasn't it? Look at his house.
He also, by the way, used to fix 2-to-1 ratio martinis. That were just
2-to-1 ratio?
Just like
you mean two parts.
Two parts gin to one part vermouth. Yeah, that was my Uncle Dudley. More coming up here on...
And more on Uncle Dudley.
On Zorba Pastor. Oh, don't forget, we have our...
our Mythbuster.
Medical Mythbuster coming up.
That's right.
We have some more research.
Right,
more of your calls too, right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Again, that number, 800 462-7413. You mentioned, Zorba, research on artificial legs, and they have something new as far as artificial legs are concerned.
Right. This is a big issue. First of all, obviously, one of the issues with artificial legs are when our vets come back, you know, from the war in the middle, you know, in Iraq, that we have a lot of vets who have injured themselves and have especially have had loss of legs. The major loss of amputation in this country occurs in diabetics. I mean, that's still the number one, absolutely beyond a shadow of a doubt, loss. And the problem with amputations are amputations below the knee are different than amputations above the knee. In other words, we need our knee to move around and bend and to be able to walk, you know, to walk in places. And when the knee is gone, it's a harder amputation.
Yeah.
Just harder to actually walk and get around. So this is a brand new bionic power knee and leg. It's sort of, it's a leg prosthesis with a knee that learns how you walk and what you're doing and then has motors in it that help, as you could picture in your brain, with an artificial knee that gives you a power assist.
A kind of an intelligence in the knee?
It's an intelligence that learns how you're walking. So here it is, you know, you're walking with your leg, and the knee then learns how you are walking and moving and begins to adjust with these micro motors, these small motors. They complain the knee is a little noisy, makes some sound to it, you know, but it's noisier for the person because the noise is transmitted through the body. But it allows you then to walk better and function better. And one of the issues that is so important, especially if you've had a traumatic knee amputation, either in the war, it's always traumatic psychologically, is getting up and moving around. And being able to function in society and go outside and do things and and hopefully be able to walk uphill and downhill and not have people necessarily notice what you're doing but sort of blend into society. So this will help our vets, you know, as they blend back into
the
real
people,
world.
Do people with diabetes have usually amputations below?
Well, most of the amputations occur. What you want to do is try to save the knee. So most amputations are below the knee than above the knee. And quite often the people who need it above the knee are ones who have bad vascular system. And so often the below the knee just doesn't heal well, and they have to go up higher because the closer you get to the central circulation, the more circulation you have. The problem is once you lose your leg and your knee, you can still have pain there. The pain is one issue. You know, a phantom limb pain is a big issue. But the other issue, once again, is the society issue of how, you know, how you judge yourself and how other people judge you, too.
There must be cost issue involved, too.
$100,000. $100,000. Very expensive.
I assume vets can get this.
Well, they get it. They will be able to get it, hopefully, if it works and as it develops more. And then as more people use it, the price will go down. But I think this is a major step forward in helping our vets when they come back, because these are often young men and young women, to get back into society, which then helps them essentially get over the war injury that they had.
We'll take a call at 800-462-7413. A listener with us now, Zorba, in St. Louis, Missouri. Hi.
Hi, Zorba. Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on the show.
We appreciate the call. How can we help?
Well, I have an interesting question. I've noticed, I'm a high school teacher, and I've noticed that my students are regularly carrying around these energy drinks. These giant cans of energy boosters, and they're drinking more than one of them a day. And I just wondered, I've tried them before, and they sometimes kind of make you feel a little bit weird, a little bit anxious. I didn't know if there were any bad effects from these drinks exactly what was in them.
Are they constantly getting out of their seats and throwing things at you? And
I try to keep them from throwing things at me, but, you know.
Are they more hyper, do you think, than they used to be?
It's hard to say.
Yeah.
It's really hard to say.
Let's get a doctor in on this.
But this is not a small issue. This is a great big issue that's been in the medical literature, has been in the lay literature. There was a front page of one section article in the Sunday New York Times a few weeks ago just on this, the proliferation of energy drinks. And they are the major step forward in terms of soft drink manufacturing. They're big bucks. And basically, they are caffeinated drinks. That's what they are. So they're souped-up caffeinated drinks. So let's say, for instance, a standard drink of Coke might be the equivalent of a weak cup of coffee. An energy drink is equal to a double espresso in terms of the amount of caffeine. It has a triple or quadruple the amount of caffeine generally that you would have in a soft drink. So what's it doing? Well, it's a lot of caffeine. You know, is this good for our kids? Well, it's a drug. It's caffeine. Of course, caffeine is a legal drug, and you can argue and say, You know, it's caffeine, doesn't mean very much. But, you know, when you look at teenagers who have a lot of energy and who are growing, is this a useful thing to have? The jury's kind of out on it. You know, I feel that, you know, having 300 to 400 milligrams a day of caffeine, which a lot of kids get through energy drinks, is way too much.
What about these other ingredients in it, like I noticed taurine.
Yeah, they put all this stuff in it. They put all this stuff. Basically, what they put in are supplements that they say will boost energy and make their drink better than others. And there's no evidence that any of these supplements do anything. There is evidence caffeine does something, and that's where the buzz comes from. It comes really from, well, the placebo effect. I'm having my energy drink, and it's the caffeine that gives you the buzz. The other stuff, you know, there's not a lot of science involved here. For the most part, this is caffeine plus supplements. That's what they are. They're sort of natural, quote, natural supplements.
So you're kind of a little nervous about it, but not
I'm
totally
nervous about the equivalent of 4 to 8 cups of coffee in a teenager who's 15 and can't get to sleep at night to go to school. You know, here it is. They may drink their energy drinks during the day. We know that teens need more sleep. They appear to have less, but they really need 8 to 9 hours of sleep. And we know that caffeine in large amounts disturbs sleep. So I'm disturbed by that because you need sleep. It's an important part of growing up in life, and it's an important part of school. If you don't get enough sleep, you don't do as well in school. So I'm concerned about the amount of the energy drink more than the energy drink itself. Mm-hmm. I don't think the supplements hurt you, but if you're drinking 2 or 3 energy drinks, you're getting 4 to 8 amounts of the caffeine that you would get in a normal
supplement. So pass those concerns along to the students. I'm sure they will stop doing that.
Yeah, right.
Yes, well, thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Tom is right, though. If they're not throwing spitballs at you, it's a step forward, right?
800-462-7413. Time now, Zorba, for our medical myth buster. Today's myth is from a listener and sounds like a mother knows best myth. It comes to us from Heidi in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. And by the way, this is a myth to which I subscribe, Zorba, so you'll say whether other people and I are wrong about this. She writes, I heard from my mother when I was young that if your wound is exposed to air, it heals faster. This is why sores in your mouth take forever to heal. Is this true?
You know, it's so interesting. Her mother must have talked to my mother and every other mother in America, you know, who said, well, keep it open because it's important for it to get some air so it can breathe. It's so funny. I mean, who got the idea that skin breathes? I mean, where did that come
from?
So
that's not true?
You breathe through your nose, you breathe through your mouth. It's a total myth. And it's been a total myth.
No, it isn't. I believe that all my life.
Absolutely is a total myth that you should leave this thing open because it'll
actually heal better. But the air kind of goes by and it makes it heal faster. Shut up.
My mom told me, leave it open. Keep it open tonight. It doesn't work. What you want to do is just the opposite. You want to soak and slowly remove the scab. In other words, you don't want to use trauma to leave the scab, and it's okay if it bleeds a little bit. Then you want to keep the area a little moist with a little antibiotic ointment. And then if you want to, because you have to protect it, you can put a Band-Aid on so you don't have to look at it.
Yeah.
What's even better than a Band-Aid are the new liquid Band-Aids that go on top of it, because they're a gel that basically goes on top, and as the skin forms on, the gel eventually stops. But some people like a Band-Aid. I tend to like a Band-Aid.
I had a Band-Aid.
But the ointment really does work. Antibiotic ointment is great. Frankly,
I was going to do an aha with you. I had a Band-Aid on a little owie on my finger from yesterday, and I just took it off. Yeah. I was going to say, look at this. It isn't healing because the air isn't getting.
No, it's not the case.
But it is kind of healing with the Band-Aid
on.
Yeah,
you see? But the main thing is to keep it moist. The other thing is, if you're taking an aspirin tablet a day, you don't heal as quickly because you tend to bleed a little bit more.
Oh,
that's what I've discovered. I take an 81 milligram aspirin every day, and what happens is it takes a little longer for me to heal.
So. Okay, do you have a medical myth? We'll try to bust it or prove it right. Just send it along in an email with the subject titled Myth Buster. Make sure to send that email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Let's help another listener if we can. One in Liberty Lake, Washington. Hi.
Hi there.
What's up?
My daughter is about 12 years old, and she absolutely loves to play soccer, but she gets a terrible skin rash on her legs from the shin guards and the socks and the irritation and running. And we've had one doctor prescribe Elidel, and we've had other doctors say, don't touch the stuff, it's not safe for kids. So my question is Elidel safe to use on kids with eczema, skin rashes, or
Or is there another less medical, or, you know, less potentially harmful solution?
Well, basically, what we often do with skin rashes of an eczemoid nature, there are a variety of different things that we use. If it's, this is on the shin, you said?
Yeah,
on the leg?
On the front of her leg.
Yeah, often the cheapest, most inexpensive thing is you start with over-the-counter 0.5% hydrocortisone, which is the strongest you can get.
Mm-hmm.
And then if that doesn't work, you call your doctor for something that's really cheaper, and it's 2.5% hydrocortisone cream. And we've been using that for years on my minor rashes with children, not on the face, very important, not on the face. We use them in other areas, and usually that works pretty well. And if that doesn't work, I think Elidel, which is a different type of a steroid cream, really is okay to use. I mean, but I think you just, you know, use this judiciously, and then you go back to a hydrocortisone-type cream to use. But so how long has she had the rash for?
Oh, virtually since she was a baby. It just changes where it erupts based
on... How old is she now?
12.
And what kind of soap do you use? Do you use, Dove soap or Basis?
We've gone to Cheer Free Laundry Detergent.
Good.
We use Aquaphor or
Excellent.
Eucerin
Excellent.
Calming Cream.
Perfect. That's exactly
and
right.
And we buy hypoallergenic suntan lotion.
Super.
We try
that's
to go
all,
the whole
that,
route.
That is all the right stuff that you should be doing, basically, for your daughter. That's all the right stuff. I would keep up with that. And I think the Elidel is really an okay cream to use. But I'd use hydrocortisone first. Cheaper, more inexpensive, and if that works, that's what I'd start
with. Then stick with that.
You bet.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your help. I've enjoyed visiting with you.
A pleasure.
Well, we've enjoyed it, too.
Thanks.
Thank you so much for the call. Zorba, let's grab a quick tip from our Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox. Now, from time to time, we chat about toenail fungus. Well, two of our listeners, Mary Kay in De Pere, Wisconsin, and Kathy in Wichita, Kansas, have offered us one using the mouthwash, Listerine. They say that soaking their toes long and often in Listerine has helped relieve their toenail fungus, and it's a lot cheaper than fungus medications.
Well, I think it's a great idea. This is a good example of a folk remedy that may actually work for people. I think people ought to try it. It's cheap, it's inexpensive, and your feet smell good, you know, when you're all done.
Yeah.
I think I definitely would try it. That's a great idea. I'm going to have to try it with people and see if it works.
Yeah.
You know, if they say it works, it certainly is worth a try. Absolutely. Well, wow, that would be fabulous.
And it's cheap, says Zorba. Keep those helpful hints coming.
And it's cheap.
Keep those helpful hints coming. Just send your tips, comments, and questions in an email to...
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week.
A pleasure, Tom, and stay well.
For a copy of this week's recipe and all things Zorba, visit us on the web
at zorbapastor.org.
And don't forget, Adam is available, well, semi-available now, anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio, produced by Adam Friedrich. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director. Gigi Holland fills your recipe requests. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, expecting you to be with us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
For a copy of today's show, call the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0428C. To buy Zorba's book, The Longevity Code, Your Personal Prescription for a Longer, Sweeter Life, or to pick up a copy of Zorba's Heart Healthy Cookbook, just go to our website at zorbapastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.